The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. A few hoops that we're trying to fly through here this morning. There's another problem with the websites at our headquarters campus, and we're trying to get the live stream up on YouTube. So hopefully, well, it looks like some of you may just have to catch this program later today. We're recording it. So the podcast will definitely be up at the websites later on, or we can tweet out something that will allow for you to listen to this. But we're not even sure actually if the signal's going out there in the local area in Edmond. But we'll get the message out. And speaking of Edmond, by the way, we used the technology well enough yesterday with our annual speech banquet, 9 speeches. 2 of them presented here at Edstone and 7 of them at Edmond, and both campuses linked together as we were able to watch the video from Edmond, and they were able to watch the video from Edstone. So some wonderful speeches last night from our students on just a variety of subjects, very informative, very inspired deliveries. So we were all excited here at Edstone. We had a mid-evening or early evening dinner, and they had a mid-morning brunch over in Edmond. So a wonderful occasion, lots of effort put into the event on both sides of the Atlantic, from the kitchen and from the event organizers. So we certainly do appreciate that, and just the wonderful royal standard that is continually on display with our formal events at God's College. Well, today in the United States, it's President's Day, and so coming up later on today's program, we'll spend a little bit of time talking about Abraham Lincoln and some lessons that we can take away from his presidency, the 16th president of the United States, one of America's greatest presidents ever. And I think it's a good study following on the point we made on Friday's show about perseverance and just looking at the example of Winston Churchill. So we'll delve into that more deeply in the second segment. One other little tidbit here is we had here in the UK the program that played over the weekend advertised. It was also the first one that we've posted from the new studio here in the attic. There's still some things we want to tweak, but if you'd like to see what that studio and the background looks like, you can get to that at our website, assuming the website's available at some point. In any event, here in the UK, we got 155 responses, a really strong response to that program, advertising for the first time the pivotal sign that we're living in the last days. That's the name of our new booklet. Well, lots going on over the weekend, even on Friday following our show with the president announcing the national emergency, and then the predictable cry or outrage that you heard coming from his opposition party and from the mainstream media. We touched on the Andrew McCabe interview on Friday, the clips that came out in advance of his 60 Minutes interview, and that, of course, was on the air last night, and then the president tweeting out quite a few responses to that program. And so lots going on, and I'm sure as the weekly news cycle begins today in the United States, what gets lost in all of this is a lot of real news, a lot of important news, like, for instance, the Munich Security Conference. And we prepared you for this last week, I know. But you just see, it's like Richard was saying this morning, to paraphrase Jeremiah 1, it's like a seething pot. In Europe, you see this resentment now, this animosity, all of this contempt for the United States of America. And the reason this is so significant is that for many, many years, even at this conference, the Munich Security Conference, usually this conference is meant to be a display or a platform to highlight just how close the relationship is between the United States and Europe. Even in years past, when things were just a little bit difficult or rocky, they'd still, both sides would still come together and at least say, hey, despite our differences, it's a wonderful relationship. The relationship is as strong as ever. But that's not the tone at the Munich Security Conference. Not anymore. Political came out with the headline, "A Transatlantic Atomic Blast from the Past." Provocative headline. And they're probably trying to get clicks, of course. But still, it talks about the growing tension between these two and how that it's gone nuclear. Just when it looked like the U.S. and the EU had run out of things to fight about, it says a fresh rift has emerged over how to forestall a new arms race with Russia in the wake of the collapse of a Cold Era war or a Cold War era treaty designed to keep mid-range nuclear weapons out of Europe. So this was one of the bigger takeaways from the conference. This rift that's emerging, this new arms race with Russia, and the fact that the continent's not going to be able to rely on that American security umbrella for much longer. German foreign policy weighed in, saying the power struggle between Berlin and Washington at the Munich Security Conference has become more open than ever before. A great struggle for power. And it's more open and obvious now. Now more than ever. It says, as German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said at the security conference, also with a view to the dispute with Washington, Europe faces the question of the future as to whether it will be subject or object of world politics. It says it must therefore now transform geoeconomic into geopolitical capital in order to become a mainstay of international order and develop its own geopolitical identity. It sounds so good to so many different players. Yeah, they need to have their own identity. Yeah, Germany needs to lead the way. Well, if you have an understanding, though, of history, what happens when you have a German-dominated continental Europe that looks upon the United States with contempt? And Britain, too. The New York Times says it's no longer worth pretending Donald Trump is not in the authoritarian camp. The shock has passed. European powers are thinking again. They're thinking again. There's the New York Times cheering them on. Hey, if you're a part of the resistance, come join us. Donald Trump is the authoritarian. That's what the New York Times is peddling. Unbelievable nonsense. Instead, what we see happening is Europe hastily moving in the opposite direction of the United States. And in some cases, the United States leaders, as you'll hear here in just a second, they're calling out Europe, European leaders, for not paying their fair share in the case of NATO. Or for cozying up to Russia with the Nord Stream project. Vice President Pence, he was at the conference over the weekend, and he criticized Germany for this Nord Stream project. You can hear that here in the first clip. Play clip one.
America and our allies have stood strong. We've stood strong against efforts as well to divide our alliance through political interference or the use of energy resources. And the United States commends all our European partners who've taken a strong stand against Nord Stream 2. And we commend others to do the same. We've also made it clear that we will not stand idly by while NATO allies purchase weapons from our adversaries. We cannot ensure the defense of the West if our allies grow dependent on the East.
Couple of statements there worthy of our attention. The fact that There's some who have spoken out against this Nord Stream pipeline deal with Russia. And he says, we commend others to do the same. And then also, he's critical there of people purchasing weapons and such from our adversaries. So this isn't something that's just been brought on by Donald Trump, and he's the only problem. He is, like my father's pointed out, he's exposed. He does a pretty good job of pointing out the problems, seeing some of the problems, and you can see how much Europe hates that. They're not responding well to the correction. And then there's, and he kind of alluded to it there with cozying up to some of America's adversaries. But then when he got on the subject of the Iran nuclear deal, here's what he had to say on that, clip two.
It was remarkable to see leaders from across the region agreeing that the greatest threat to peace and security in the Middle East is the Islamic Republic of Iran. As I said at that gathering, the time has come for all of us to act. The time has come for our European partners to stop undermining U.S. sanctions against this murderous revolutionary regime. The time has come for our European partners to stand with us and with the Iranian people, our allies and friends in the region. The time has come for our European partners to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and join us as we bring the economic and diplomatic pressure necessary to give the Iranian people, the region, and the world the peace, security, and freedom they deserve.
If you just step back here, really, it's pretty amazing to think about what's happened over the past 10 years or so. The fact that Europe is now siding, and again, Europe, led by Germany, is siding with the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. And they're fighting against the world's largest sponsor of freedom and democracy. Just think about going back 10, 15 years. You never would have seen this. It just highlights how dramatic the changes have been for the world in the last few years even. Early on in the war against terrorism, there was just a much stronger show of solidarity between the United States, Britain, and all of Europe as they banded together to fight for freedom in Afghanistan, in Iraq, to stand against Iran. But not now. Here comes Donald Trump. He does away with the nuke deal. And Europe, many of them, they're not going along with that. They're cozying up to America's greatest adversary in the Middle East, the Islamic Republic of Iran. So there you have Vice President Pence speaking at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend. And as it happens, Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, she spoke right after Mr. Pence, and she stood up to him forcefully. Now, her speech was in German, so we don't have any clips to play for you. But Carnegie Europe, it had this article titled, Merkel Comes to Town and How. And the article talks about all of the pushback that she offered right after the vice president spoke. She condemned the prospect of a trade war between Europe and the U.S., saying that Mr. Trump's warning of imposing tariffs and such, that it was a national security threat. She said it was frightening. This is the German chancellor standing up to the American vice president. She asked this, is it a good idea for the Americans to suddenly and quickly withdraw from Syria? Here's another criticism. Or will it once more strengthen the capacity of Iran and Russia to exert their influence? So she takes a shot at America for its stance on Syria, and I'll come more to that here in just a second as well, with the defeat of ISIS and how that's impacting European nations, Britain, the United States. But Ms. Merkel then went on to defend Germany importing its gas from Russia, saying that, as she put it, a Russian gas molecule is a Russian gas molecule, no matter whether it comes via Ukraine or through the Baltic Sea. She said further on, geostrategically, Europe can't have an interest in cutting off all relations with Russia. You can't expect for us to break up this deal or to cut off relations with Russia. Isn't that amazing? Because here in the United States, the president's just constantly bombarded with these charges that he's cozying up to Russia. He's the one saying to Europe, look, what are you doing deals with Putin for? We've got all kinds of deals we can make with you with respect to energy and fuel and gas and so on. But she made it clear, Ms. Merkel, she made it clear which side she's on. It says here, this is from the Carnegie Europe report, it says, it's not often that Angela Merkel shows such emotion, but when she ended her cracking speech during day two of the Munich Security Conference, the participants, who were packed like sardines into the banqueting hall of the Hotel Bayerischer Hof, all stood up. They gave the German chancellor a long and loud applause. She really did have to fight back her tears, of all things. A long, sustained applause. And it made her really emotional. Now, I don't know if it was in the same hall. I suspect it was in something different. The hall might have been a little bit smaller. But you had, in this other speech that Mr. Pence gave, I think it was for some kind of inaugural award that they're starting now in memory of the late Senator John McCain. And so he opens his speech, about a 13-14 minute speech, by bringing greetings to the dignitaries in that room. And quite a few of them were U.S. officials, current and former, sitting there in this room. And listen to, I just wanted to include a couple of thoughts put together so that you could get an idea with the gap, the silence after he greets the room from President Trump, and nothing, you hear nothing. You hear this really awkward silence that goes on for several seconds. Listen to it for yourself. This is clip three.
To them and to all of you, I bring greetings from a great champion of freedom and of a strong national defense who has worked with these members of Congress to strengthen America's military might and to strengthen the leadership of the free world. I bring greetings from the 45th President of the United States of America, President Donald Trump. Last August,
that was the actual tape. It's actually on video, too. You can watch him waiting there behind the podium for something, anything. Instead, 5-6 seconds of nothing. Dead silent. So what does this conference expose? What is it revealing other than this widening rift between Europe and the United States? And how significant is that? Prophetically, we know it's significant because your Bible says that seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, that they will attack the United States, that they will attack Great Britain. And so the fact that we see this widening rift, it should come as no surprise for all of our differences in the past, during the Obama years, during the Bush years, during the Clinton years, you had a platform like this, the Munich Security Conference, and it was meant to say, hey, we've got some differences, but look, we're standing together. We're united as never before. We've got NATO. We've got all these alliances. We're united in our fight against terrorism. We're joining the coalition for Afghanistan or for Iraq or wherever. You don't see that same thing happening today. Now, with respect to that energy deal, you'll recall some of you from our writings and also my father's own programs, what he said about the Nord Stream 2 project, His article from September, specifically Germany and Russia's secret war against America. Everyone's so concerned in the United States about President Trump's supposed ties to Putin and Russia. It's this collusion that ought to be alarming. It's this collusion that people ought to be up in arms over, considering, again, the history right before World War II. Germany and Russia's secret war against America. It says, for years, Germany's been criticized, this is my father writing, criticized for the Nord Stream projects, but it pays no attention and presses ahead. This shows Germany is uninterested in relying on NATO anymore. President Trump exposed this in public and criticized Merkel. Germany is totally controlled by Russia, Donald Trump said. This is from my father's September article. And it's concerning the Nord Stream deal, because they will be getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO, and I don't think it should have happened. That's President Trump coming out last year criticizing this deal. As my father went on to say in that article, this project, that pipeline project, it's meant to wreck NATO. That's where this is headed. I mentioned that last week. They want NATO gone. They want to see that alliance end. Because on comes the European army to fill that security void. And, of course, that security umbrella, it's very quickly going to go on the offensive. That's what your Bible says. That's what your Bible prophesies. A boiling pot. Jeremiah 1 and verse 13. God showed the prophet, his prophet, a vision of a seething pot. A seething pot, which it has a face, it says, thereof toward the north. That's describing Europe today. A German-dominated Europe today. And we're seeing so many examples. The Munich Conference exposes this widening rift. President Trump, by the way, he tweeted out yesterday, because ISIS has now pretty much been crushed, and you have a lot of refugees, women and children, left in the wake of this destruction. He tweeted this: the United States is asking Britain, France, Germany, and other European allies to take back over 800 ISIS fighters that we captured in Syria and put them on trial. Mr. Trump said the caliphate is ready to fall. The alternative is not a good one, in that we will be forced to release them. So the caliphate's been destroyed. And as you know, President Trump announced in December that the United States is pulling out. And so we have here we have all these ISIS fighters that have been captured, 800 of them. And the president's calling upon European nations. Most of them come from Europe. A lot of them come from right here in Britain. And here again is the president of the U.S. saying, all right, we're about to leave, and we don't want to just leave them in Syria. So you've got to take on some of this burden yourself. It's a message that, as we keep seeing, it's not very popular, is it, to call them out? To say that, well, you bear a certain amount of responsibility for this as well. The Guardian says the president's call came as he prepared to claim the end of the caliphate in northwest Syria with the fall of the final ISIS-held town. So ISIS is out of options. They've lost all control of all of those towns in Syria and Iraq. It says some European countries, notably France, have said they are preparing to take back their former jihadists, but the UK has been more resistant. It says that fighters held by the West Syrian Kurd allies can only return if they seek consular help in Turkey. The UK government says it faces a dilemma, especially concerning the wives and children of British fighters, and a major challenge either to prosecute the fighters or prevent them from undertaking terrorist acts in their homeland. So this was quite a controversial development last week. I didn't have time to get to it on Friday's program. But you have a lot of commentators here in Britain that are saying we don't want to take them back just for security reasons. Or others who say, well, if they come back, they need to be prosecuted, just like the president tweeted. You need to prosecute them in your courts. Put them on trial, he said. Listen to this. This is shocking from the British Telegraph. It says the United States is planning to send British ISIS fighters to Guantanamo Bay amid frustration at the UK's failure to take responsibility for its homegrown terrorists. This is from the Telegraph, saying that President Trump and the U.S., they're considering putting some of those ISIS fighters at Guantanamo just to keep them off the streets. It says it has emerged that the vast majority of Islamist fighters returning to the U.K. from Syria have been placed on secretive government rehabilitation schemes rather than prosecuted. So the ones that do come back, the British government's trying to rehabilitate them rather than prosecute them. Now think about this. Here are fighters who went to Syria and did who knows what. We've seen some of the footage of the worst of it. Or these young women running off to Syria through Turkey so that they can marry an ISIS fighter. That was in the news a few years ago. These three teenage girls that flew from Heathrow, I think it was, to Istanbul and then went across the border. Teenagers, late teens. They wanted to join the fight. They wanted to join ISIS. And they did, and, well, now ISIS has been crushed. Those girls are now moms. They've got one of them anyway as a little kid and is basically demanding the British government to rescue her from a refugee camp. Come pick me up. And she doesn't even really have any remorse. I'll get to that in just a second. But so here's the United States. The United States is saying, look, if you're not going to be tougher on them, we'll put them in Gitmo. And then, of course, that's criticized. The Guardian, quoting from some gal heading up Amnesty International, she's quoted as saying, Guantanamo continues to operate as a symbol of Islamophobia that embodies the fear-mongering and xenophobia that defines Trump's presidency. It's all Donald Trump's fault. He's the only villain that you just consistently see in every story. You feel like asking Amnesty International, well, what do you suggest we do? Did you see what ISIS was doing? And now they've been crushed. And now there's these 800 ISIS fighters. Where should they be sent? What are your ideas? Look, the world is a mess. There's no getting around that. But this constant refrain of all things Donald Trump. What a tired cop-out that is. This world is about to explode in violence. And what an example, as we've said so many times before, of our strength being spent in vain. We have this huge problem right in front of us. We go in, we take care of the problem, we think. ISIS, of course, is not the big problem. In many ways, pardon the reference, in many ways they are like the JV team, because Iran is the real problem. But we get in there, we crush ISIS, we think it's a victory, we announce it as a victory, and then we try to get out and look at the problems, more problems. Well, hey, France and Germany and Britain, you've got to take care of your former ISIS fighters. These are British citizens. These are French citizens, some of them. These are German citizens. And then if the United States tries to do something to secure the world, well, then there's an outcry there, too, because they don't like the current president. So he's the problem. Guantanamo Bay, it's a symbol of Donald Trump. This Telegraph piece about the woman who says that the British government should come rescue her, basically, from this refugee camp. The Telegraph says millions of us will recoil at the notion of Begum, that's one of the girls, being allowed to come home to Britain, as she now says she wants, after fleeing ISIS's last stand and making her way to a refugee camp. Although she claims she has no regrets about joining Islamic State, Begum's lawyers will no doubt be delighted to exploit the very freedoms and human rights which ISIS exists to wipe out. There's the irony. Now she's got her lawyers. Now they're going to be exploiting the very freedoms and human rights that nations like Britain and the United States are known for. The Telegraph says here, this makes otherwise compassionate people very cross. So does the thought of as many as 80 other British women and their children, including members of Britain's biggest suspected female terror cell, being waved back into the UK, where at worst they are required to attend touchingly optimistic de-radicalization classes. It says, regardless of the risk they may pose to innocent people. And then listen to this. It says, you know, there is a young woman I do feel sorry for, Lucy Henning. Lucy was just 17 years old in 2014 when her lovely taxi driver dad went to Syria to help deliver aid after being deeply affected by the plight of orphans. Henning was captured and held hostage by the Islamic State for 10 frightful months before they took him into the desert, dressed him in an orange jumpsuit, and beheaded him. Lucy hoped and prayed her father would survive until she saw a picture on Instagram of his headless corpse. The Telegraph says here, finally, make no mistake, those three Bethnal Green schoolgirls were fully aware of what had happened to Alan Henning and other ISIS captives before they set off to marry the fiends who slaughtered them. And then he talks about a statement, even, that one of those girls who's trying now to get back into Britain, one of the statements from one of those girls who said about those journalists that were being beheaded there, remember, almost every month it seemed like. Well, I mean, those journalists could have been spies. They were a threat to the ISIS state, she said. And now they're wanting back home. Now they want freedom. The freedom that Britain protects. They want human rights. Now they're a human rights champion. Strength spent in vain. Well, there's another story about one that's wanting to go back to Alabama. This ISIS fighter, this gal, who also left, didn't tell her parents. She just flew to Turkey and got into Syria. And, of course, if you look at her Twitter feed, Instagram, all that stuff, just the most vile, hateful comments in recent years. At least according to the story with her, she's expressing sorrow now that her life is miserable and she wants back into the United States. And there is, at least from the article's perspective, some contrition. Who knows, though? 800. And how many of them that are sitting in de-radicalization classes are going to turn out to be hardened criminals in the UK? I guess we wait to see. Strength spent in vain. President Trump talked about Syria or Afghanistan. I gave the program last week, just running through the region. He talked about it in terms of it being an unwinnable war. And we're certainly seeing the truth of that as it plays out week by week by week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll look at the example on this President's Day in the United States. We'll look at the example, or one of them, from President Lincoln's presidency. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
And welcome back to the program. Just in looking at YouTube over the promo there, it looks like our stream is working. Something like 68 are listening in right now. We don't have the video stream this time, just too short of notice. But we've got the audio moving, thankfully. I think it was unlisted there at the start. In any event, spread the word, as hopefully the podcast will be up, if all goes well with the websites, later on today so that people can catch up on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, it was a cold, rainy morning back in February of 1861, when about 1,000 well-wishers gathered at the Great Western Railroad station there in Springfield, Illinois, and they were there to see off the president-elect, Abraham Lincoln. And before leaving, before the train departed, Lincoln made a few impromptu remarks to the crowd. He said, "My friends, no one, not in my situation, can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington." He said, "Without the assistance of that divine being, whoever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail." It says, "Trusting in him who can go with me and remain with you and be everywhere for good, let us confidently hope that all will be yet well." Those are impromptu remarks and multiple references to the great Creator God. And this nation, the United States, certainly needed God's help at that trying time. 1 week later, 1 week after those remarks, Jefferson Davis took his oath as the president of the so-called Confederate States of America, while James Buchanan, the man Lincoln would replace in Washington, D.C., he had pretty much given up all hope for saving the Union. Buchanan had even declared himself to be the last president of the United States. He gave up. He quit. And so the task of saving the Union had fallen squarely upon the shoulders of Abraham Lincoln. By the time Lincoln arrived in Washington, to prepare for his March 4th inauguration, again, 1861. By the time of that inauguration, there's seven states that had seceded from the Union, and then rebel forces had seized control of federal agencies and military outposts in the South. And that provided the South with enough arms and supplies to amass a formidable foe, a formidable army. And the South also gained control of much of the Mississippi River, the main artery, the main waterway from the Midwest there through to the Gulf of Mexico. That was the nation's lifeline for trade and commerce. And then to make matters worse, Washington, D.C., the capital city, was left virtually defenseless when Lincoln arrived. So the capital wasn't even protected. The South very quickly grabbed hold of everything that they needed, at least in their territory. And the resistance was in full swing. So Abraham Lincoln, this is how his presidency started. And many saw him as just kind of a hick, uneducated, unqualified. And here he's thrust into this presidential office at a time when really America was facing its greatest trial. It threatened the very existence of the United States of America. Now, there's so many lessons, obviously, that we can take away from this. And I've talked before about just what we have been immersed into during this final era of God's church. And we've witnessed, so many of us have witnessed so much destruction, a spiritual abomination of desolation. And we really are, in so many ways, fighting for the Union, so to speak, fighting for God's work, fighting for the church. And sometimes, just like in the Civil War, there's some difficult setbacks, even losses from time to time. But if we stay with God, we win in the end. We are assured the ultimate victory. I think most people are well aware of the struggle that Abraham Lincoln had with just finding generals who would fight, who would go on the offensive, who would fight to win. He got quite discouraged early on in the war. 1862, there's just one embarrassing defeat after another. And Lincoln was deeply discouraged, very frustrated by the North's lack of military leadership, but he would not give up. It's very similar in some ways, very similar in many ways to what I was talking about on Friday with Churchill. Perseverance, he stayed the course. And in that same year, 1862, Lincoln appealed to Congress for support. This is December of 1862. But he said that the land given to the people of the United States was given to one national family, one united family, and he wasn't going to see it split apart. God's given us this land. God gave it to one family. Then toward the end of that speech, President Lincoln said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present." The United States was coming upon uncharted waters. Everything had changed. That's what he was getting at. He said, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. Our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew." He said, "We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." Some powerful words there in that speech from December of 1862. He said, "Disenthrall ourselves." In other words, free. We've got to free ourselves from anything that would prevent us from thinking anew, from thinking differently. They had to, because the country had never been through anything like that before. So they were blazing a new trail, for sure. A terrifying one, in many respects. Well, I can remember going back several years ago, my father talking about us in God's church. He was speaking specifically to the editorial department, but he talked about the all-out war that we're engaged in spiritually. And he explained how hungry wolves just love to break into a pack of defenseless sheep. But then if you look at this one very unique verse, Matthew 10 and verse 16, this is from Jesus. He said, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be you therefore as wise as serpents and harmless as doves." You're familiar with that verse, no doubt. But my father quoted from Lang's commentary, saying that this is like a few sheep invading a territory of wolves. Imagine that. You can't even imagine it. We pass hundreds of sheep every time we come onto this property, and you don't get the impression anytime you go by them that they're going to be taking on a wolf anytime soon. But that's what Jesus said to us, God's people, God's saints. We've got to be some kind of unique sheep. We're sheep, but we've got to think differently. We've got to be courageous enough to invade even a territory dominated by wolves. And even in that verse I just read to you, he said there, Jesus did, be as wise as serpents. Now, you look in other places of the Bible. Of course, Genesis 3 comes to mind. And in that passage, the serpent is a creature that symbolized the devil. So here we are fighting against the devil, Satan the devil and his demon army. And Christ admonished us. He said, you've got to be just as cunning as our adversary. You've got to go forth and conquer him. Now, we want to be as harmless as doves along the way. We want to submit to God's laws. We want to live the way of love, live the way of give. But there's no compromise when it comes to facing off against our enemy, our adversary. We have to fight. We have to go on the offensive. We have to conquer. Herbert Armstrong died in 1986. And since then, well, immediately upon his death, there was a civil war in the church. The book of Daniel says that the work actually stopped for a period of 1,150 days. And then we entered into a period of no more delay. You can read about that in Revelation 10. The start of this work, Malachi's message. I'm going to be talking more about that this Sunday at our online PAC event. That's Sunday at 4 p.m. here in the UK, and I guess that would be 5 p.m. in Europe, 10 a.m. in the Oklahoma area. But as Malachi's message brings out, there was a great civil war of sorts that started off when Herbert Armstrong died. But God's work of raising those ruins, right in the midst of all that destruction, it started in haste. Early on, late 1989, early 1990, and there were a few courageous sheep at the time, just a few, who had to really think differently, who had to think anew, who had to disenthrall themselves. Lincoln said in that same speech, "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. That's just one speech coming from one man, one carnal-minded man who loved his country, who believed in God, who believed that the United States was making history. We cannot escape that, he said. And neither can we escape our own history. You project ahead, future generations, year, generation after generation after generation, on into the wonderful world of tomorrow. People are going to be looking back at this time, this period of warfare that we're in, and wanting to learn from it. Lincoln said, "The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We say we are for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this." He was stirring the nation to act. This was a stir to action speech given before Congress. We need to be united. We need to be together. We need to see just how dangerous a house divided really and truly is. Isn't this a message that should resonate today in the halls of Congress? As it is, there's bitter division. And then you see it spill over into Europe. American diplomats going to Munich so that they can trash their own president. That's right. Diplomats, former diplomats, who despise the current occupant of the White House. We say we're for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this, Lincoln said. You can see just how important it is for us to be solid, solidly grounded in that sure foundation of God's word. The Apostle James, he wrote that those who waver back and forth, they're double-minded. They waver. They're not stable. And that ends up bringing war. Now is our opportunity, those of you listening to this broadcast, now is your opportunity to act. Those who read the trumpet, those who attend the PAC events, those who watch the Key of David. Now is the time to act. To act on this truth. Just like those of Lincoln's day. If we say we're for the Union, if we say we're for God's work, if we say we're for the truth, then this world, and more importantly, God and Jesus Christ at his right hand, they will not forget that we say this. We can't escape our history. We have to rise to the occasion and start thinking anew. We have to inspire others, leading them into the battle, leading them to fight for Christ. That line from Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar, it says, "There's a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads to fortune, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures." What an opportunity we have, we in God's church. There's not many of us, but we're being judged. We're being judged now. 1 Peter 4:17, also James 3 and verse 1. Look at those verses later. Judgment is now upon the house of God. God needs us. We cannot fail. Lincoln said this, one final quote. It says, "We know how to save the Union. The world knows we do know how to save it." He says, "We, even we here," he's speaking to the leaders of the United States. This is a message that the leaders of the United States today desperately need. He said, "We, even we here, hold the power and bear the responsibility." Further on, he said, "We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth." The way is plain, President Lincoln said, peaceful, generous, just, a way which, if followed, The world will forever applaud, and God must forever bless. You think about some of those other statements. They're quoted in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. Mr. Armstrong talking about, or rather, Abraham Lincoln, sorry. He references Abraham Lincoln talking about the blessings to come upon our nations and just how ungrateful we are. Lincoln knew. He knew that the blessings poured upon Manasseh, that they were poured down upon one family, and God used him to keep the family together. That's not happening now, and that should sober us as we see that national family splitting apart. And there's no one in sight. There's no movement that's bringing about its unity, its preservation. It's leading to our own destruction. That's the seriousness of it. But what an inspiring message from 1862, early on in a remarkable presidency. One man, and look at what he was able to do with the faithful support of those few who answered that call in 1862. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments always to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.